and welcome back to the Total Soccer Show. My name is Daryl Grove. I'm back in studio, and sitting across from me, where I assume he's been the whole time, it's Taylor Rockwell. Hello.
Hello. I never left. You left me no food. I've been surviving off of desk water. It's been very challenging.
Desk water?
Yeah, the various water bottles that we have around the room. Yes. Yeah, and stale coffee.
It is a little bit like Signs in here.
Slightly.
But if those aliens come in here, we got them.
Yep.
So we're back.
Spoiler alert for Science.
Yes, I mean, it's about time, right?
Yeah, for the dumbest plot twist ever. our atmosphere is only 70% water, whatever.
We're going to have to talk about this later. All right. So today's show, we're going to talk a little bit Classico, a little bit Lopetegui, and a little bit U20 CONCACAF Championship / World Cup qualifying.
Let's do it.
Are you ready?
Yes.
I'm asking the listeners as well as you.
Yes, I'm ready to do that. I'm ready to rant about the president of Real Madrid, yes.
Oh, is that that's the angle you're taking? Yeah, we're going to kind of figure out
pretty much
who's to blame for what has gone wrong in the early stages of Real Madrid season.
Everyone. Messi, Luis Suarez.
I mean, Leo Messi's the one person who's not to blame, right?
I don't know. He did a very good job babysitting Luis Suarez's kids, and I feel like that's why he was able to perform the way he does, which really was the final nail in the coffin. It all connects.
So if you haven't heard the news, Lopetegui has been fired.
Yes.
As soon as Real Madrid had an announcement on the website, we knew what it was, right? Let's talk about the game that sort of got him fired, but was really just the final nail in the coffin.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, and you're not wrong, because what I read after the firing was that reports indicate that he was maybe actually fired October 6th, but they wanted to build the PR campaign and kind of leak a bunch of stuff, but that they had made the decision that long ago, and they were just sort of looking at options up until this point.
Really?
And then the situation...
Was October 6th the Alaves game?
That sounds familiar.
That late winner from a corner kick. Okay.
Yeah, I think that came from the Nando Vila article from The Athletic. More on that later on.
Interesting.
But for now, yes. So he is definitely gone, but it seems like the Classico was the final thing that just could not stand.
Okay, so before we do a full retrospective on Lopetegui at Real Madrid,
it will last roughly as long as his tenure.
Yeah, a very short show coming to a gallery near you. Let's talk about the actual game.
Sure.
5-1 to Barcelona. Mm-hmm. Luis Suarez hat-trick, I believe. Still a hat-trick when you score a penalty, right? Really good performance without Leo Messi. We had a Ronaldo-less, Messi-less Classico, and turns out you can still have a really good Classico without those two.
You sure can. I did enjoy Lopetegui in the immediate aftermath of the result saying, like, well, we had a lot of injuries to deal with and it was a big problem, and sort of the natural response to that was, you know, Leo Messi didn't play due to injury, right? Like, it was both sides.
Well, wait, let's back up to that then. I know Ronaldo's gone.
Yep.
Lopetegui says we have a lot of injuries, but like it was the classic Madrid midfield, right? Mm-hmm. It was Casemiro, Modric, Toni Kroos. It's a front three of Isco, Bale, and Benzema.
Yeah.
Ramos, defender, Varane.
I think it was Varane having to be subbed out midway through the game. That was maybe what he was alluding to, and the fact that Carvajal not looking too fit either. I think right now the story I saw on Reddit today was that they have 4 fit defenders as of today Real Madrid, because everybody's out with injury.
All right. But it's not as if it was absolutely, to use a phrase you don't like, decimated.
Yes.
Right?
How dare you? it was not, no.
Yeah, and so they still lost 5-1.
They did, and Sidlow in his Spanish football podcast, I really enjoyed the way he broke this game down, which was it was simultaneously as bad as it sounds and not as bad as it sounds.
That's
because
there
was a period of time when Madrid pulled the goal back courtesy of Marcelo, then they hit the post, and there's like a missed header from Ramos, there's a missed header from Benzema, and it could have been a little bit different because of some adjustments that were made. Barcelona make their own adjustments.
And then the final three goals are sort of late-ish, right? Yeah. Isn't it like 75th, 83rd, and deep in the game? Like
right around there, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, in some ways it was 2-1 for a long time. But to me, this game was won and lost in the first half, where essentially, in my opinion, Lopetegui got his tactics wrong, and they were 2-0 down at halftime as a result.
100% agree. Yes. Yeah. And I've seen a fair few people putting a lot of the blame on Gareth Bale for his lack of defensive effort. And I think it's worth remembering, again, this was Sidlow in that podcast pointing out that, like, that's not what Madrid have ever asked their attacking players to do, is track back aggressively.
Yeah, so I think that's exactly right. And I also think that is exactly the tactical thing I'm getting at, right? Which is, you look at this on the screen, 4-3-3 versus 4-3-3. You look at it on the field, and Madrid's 4-3-3 is what? Bale and Isco wide and high, and, you know, on the touchlines almost quite a lot. And then Barcelona's front three, so Suarez, Coutinho, and Rafinha this time, really tight together, right? They really, like, stayed in a bunch almost in the middle and had the fullbacks bomb outside. So as soon as you're not asking Bale and Isco to trap back,
yeah.
you have a 2v1 situation out wide. Mm-hmm. First two goals come from a Jordi Alba overlap.
Yeah. And I want to talk about Jordi Alba, but first I wanted to say to your point that you also had occasionally Bale and Isco switching sides, albeit briefly, mm-hmm. but they would rotate and then switch back. And I think if you keep that in mind, then of course they're not, their primary responsibility isn't, and also track back at the same time. You can't have them switch sides, but then also do a defensive job.
It was very fluid, because even, I think it's even more than mm-hmm. you're saying, because on the second goal, when you give up the penalty, it's actually, I think, Karim Benzema, who's playing right wing. Gareth Bale is in like a centre forward position. Yeah, so they're just three attackers, basically. Yeah.
But it's also the case, to your point about Barca, that if you've got those players, but you've got them spread, then when they switch, it's a bigger deal than if Barcelona have that front three sort of compact and together.
Yeah.
If it's only a 15-yard sprint to completely switch spots as opposed to a 45-yard sprint, mm-hmm. it's going to be that much easier, that much more fluid, and it's going to distract that defense that much more, which is why I think you had Madrid so compact with their back four, leaving so much space out wide.
And isn't that part of the problem,
yes.
right? Barca's compact front three made Real Madrid have a compact back four. Mm-hmm. And then when you have the overlapping Jordi Alba, I am with you and mm-hmm. I'm with Sid Lowe that Bale kind of did the right thing in asking his right back Nacho to mark the overlapper, mm-hmm. Alba.
The overlapper.
It's just that Nacho had such a long way to go mm-hmm. out to meet him, because he was essentially playing as a centre back. He was that tight in field.
Yes. Yeah? And I think that's always going to be difficult just to begin with. But then when it's Jordi Alba, who has the pace and the touch, as we saw for, I think, the first goal, or at least, for the first goal, but then also the timing, that's the biggest thing for me.
Yes.
And that's the thing I think makes him such a lethal attacking option, mm-hmm. is he really picks his spots, but when he picks them and he goes.
Because he wasn't just blindly bombing forward all the time, right? Mm-hmm. He was almost waiting for the Madrid defense to compress and Bale to be up mm-hmm. high, and then he's like, oh, look at all this grass.
Yep, and away I go. And then it's not even that he...
It's Alba time.
And this is... there we go. But it's also the case that it's not just he goes forward and then they play him into space. It's that when he makes that run, when he picks that spot, it almost seems to be, we've seen it with Messi and we've seen it now without Messi, that it's almost like everybody knows, okay, he's probably going to go, I'm just going to play that ball. So it's not the case that he's gotten forward and is wide and then they play the ball. They play the ball as he's hurtling forward.
Yeah, it's fluid,
so
right?
Then it's not even that Nacho can kind of go out and slowly shut him down when he collects the ball. Nacho is already scrambling to try to close that distance, but now he's scrambling and closing the distance on a player who's running at full speed to a through ball. That's going to be a very difficult proposition.
I agree 100%.
There we go.
Yeah. I love coming back and having some co-signed Total Soccer Show opinions.
I'll manufacture disagreement at some point. Don't worry.
LeBron's the best. No, Michael's the best. So do you want to go deeper into this game, or do you want to talk about Lopetegui? Because I feel like we're starting to get in the weeds here.
Yeah.
I like it in the weeds.
I will say this. One of like weirdly, as you know, as you age, you change your opinions on stuff. And one of the players that I think I've come around on the most is Luis Suarez. And I still, you know,
yes,
he's got all of the off and on field distractions, mostly on field, I guess, distractions. But I do think I could spend an entire game just watching him. Like I could do the Zidane 21st century portrait with Luis Suarez, mm-hmm. because he is sometimes, you know, 20 yards from his own goal. Sometimes he just stays in the opposition six. Sometimes he's out wide. He's always running. He's always moving. He's screaming. He's dramatic. And I think he's funny, too. I enjoyed in the post-match interview, they asked him like what he thought of his hat trick, and he responded, which one? Because he just had his third child this week. So that's what he was alluding to. So just moments like that, I found Luis Suarez very fun to watch, as did, it seems, Leo Messi, who was grinning happily from the sideline every time Luis Suarez scored.
What do we make of Barca without Messi looking so fearsome?
I mean, not surprising, I guess, given the way they play, that it does feel like everybody is sort of trained to play the way they're supposed to play. It's not a huge difference in this guy does this, but this guy's going to do this a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. We talked previously about maybe the timing of the decisions, that maybe when it's Ousmane Dembele, it's a second or two slower sometimes, but it felt like they had elevated their game accordingly. I thought Dembele was great when he came on.
He was, mm-hmm. right? He ran at people. I think the game had opened up, and it's really, that's his time to shine, right?
Yeah.
He's terrifying because he can go left, he can go right. You don't know which way to show him, because mm-hmm. whichever way you show him, he's going to go around you.
Yeah, and I think, and then credit on the other side to, or credit to Valverde for on the other side getting rid of, I think Rafinha made way. He moved Sergio Roberto forward. Mm-hmm. Semedo came in and played right back. And I think that was really important too, because Madrid, with the shift that they had.
They went to wing backs at halftime, right?
I think Barcelona just being a bit more direct with Sergio Roberto dribbling at people, but also just playing smart balls and not really thinking too much about it. That third Suarez goal, the header, it is just a very smart, like, driven cross from maybe 6 yards away.
And that took me by surprise.
And as the commentator said, I believe the power of the cross is what allows that header to be so powerful.
So maybe Suarez should get the assist.
Yeah, I'm good with
not
that.
Not the goal.
I'm good with that, yeah.
Well, should we talk about Lopetegui? Because he almost fixed that game, but he got it wrong from the start.
Yes.
He wasn't fired the same day, right? It was the very next day.
Yep.
There was a Real Madrid announcement letting us know that we have terminated his contract. Let's look back at Julian Lopetegui at Real Madrid.
Let's do it.
I think you texted me you wanted to, essentially, we don't do this much on TSS, you want to play the blame game.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah?
Because
we should have some music, it's like a game show.
Yeah, sure. Because I think there are at least...
Contestants are...
Yeah, perfect. We got doors. We've got three doors, because I would say there are at least three different groups that bear some responsibility for the state of Real Madrid as of now.
All right, so I wasn't involved in the pre-production of this game show, so what's behind the three doors, Tyler?
All right, I would say Lopetegui himself certainly deserves some blame for what's happened.
All right.
I would say the Real Madrid players, specifically you look at the very last goal, certainly, you know, when you've scored, when it's the fifth goal, maybe teams have switched off a little bit.
Yeah.
You would expect that not to be the case in a Clásico, but you look at that run from Arturo Vidal when he eventually scores the fifth goal, that header, nobody picks him up. It's just a 40-yard, maybe 30-yard jog, and nobody notices him. And then you see the reaction from the Madrid players, and it's just that, like, all right, well, he scored again. Let's just walk back. Not what you would expect. So I think the players...
What's behind door number three?
And then it's Florentino Perez,
there,
and I think
is.
His door is bigger than most.
And which of those rooms is the most expensively decorated?
I think you can guess.
Since you went big on Florentino Perez, let's start with him.
Like, sure.
Why do you think blame lies with him?
Sure. I think it starts going back to when...
For those who don't know, Real Madrid president.
Yes. Yeah. And it goes back to when they initially announced Lopetegui. Rory Smith, writing for the New York Times, I think today or yesterday, had a very good article that sort of broke down some of the history of Lopetegui's tenure and then what's happened since.
Always worth one of your free New York Times articles.
Agreed. And that's what I used. And his argument was that basically Lopetegui announced 3 days before the start of the World Cup, it eventually necessitates or requires or forces Spain to fire him as the national team manager.
I remember the summer.
Yeah, Hierro steps in. And the argument Rory Smith made was that basically Perez wanted that announcement public, even though Lopetegui asked him not to make it public because it would be a distraction, which it was. But Perez wanted it known because he was worried that maybe Lopetegui wasn't going to do a very good job and maybe Spain wouldn't look that good in the World Cup. And then suddenly, say Spain don't make it out of the group or crash out in the round of 16 as they did, then suddenly this whole coup he's got of signing this Spanish national team manager with all this experience doesn't look that great.
So does Rory Smith know that or is he speculating?
I don't know. He stated it more factually, in my opinion, than he did say, and it's possible, or and it makes sense that. It was much more, this is what he was thinking. And I think his argument was also that maybe Lopetegui himself wasn't so sure that he was ready to take over a ship the size of Real Madrid, but he did anyway. And so it starts there, that it's Perez essentially forcing a decision through, not really listening to common sense arguments, and then really even knowing that maybe it might not work, still disregarding that and pushing forward. Then you look at what happens after that when Cristiano Ronaldo was sold a few weeks later. Lopetegui's father has come out and said, like, my son didn't have 50 goals to work with. You can't really blame him. What I would say, though, is this is maybe more so my opinion. I feel like Ronaldo was sold with the expectation that Hazard would come in from Chelsea.
Yeah.
And I think they thought that's a guaranteed move. That's going to happen. We're good. We'll replace him. Then that falls through, and instead they sign Thibaut Courtois. And that makes, in my opinion, Perez look even worse because he's been pursuing a goalkeeper for who knows how long since fax machine gate.
Unnecessarily.
100%.
Wasn't this a whole thing last year that Zidane was happy with Keylor Navas?
The
Real Madrid players were happy with Keylor Navas. And as we understand it, the only person who wasn't that happy was maybe Perez and probably sycophants?
Yeah.
or hangers on?
Yes, man. Whatever you want to go with.
Just wanted a big name signing at goalkeeper.
And so he gets that in the form of Thibaut Courtois this summer. But now you've sold Ronaldo, your best player, I would say. You haven't replaced that attacking threat. Instead, you're going to try to replace him with some squad depth. Okay.
Yeah.
And then instead you signed a goalkeeper that you maybe don't need, and that's about it. Mm-hmm. And then you also get rid of Kovacic. That factors in too.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah. And so you look at that squad now, and it's a squad that already finished third last season, 16 points behind Barcelona, and you've like noticeably weakened them with a manager that we were doing what the calculations. There's an argument to be made that it is his sixth choice manager. Perez's sixth choice manager was Lopetegui.
Yeah. So just to correct you, 17 points behind Barcelona.
Oh boy.
And 3 points behind Atletico. Real Madrid finished third in La Liga last season. I think the Champions League win put a lot of gloss on their season. Mm-hmm. But it actually wasn't a good season, right? Didn't win Copa del Rey, didn't come close to winning La Liga. It was a team that obviously needed strengthening. Instead, lose Ronaldo, replace your good goalkeeper, lose Kovacic, and not bring in any major replacements. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Yeah.
And then you have a bunch of players who just played the World Cup,
right.
A lot of tired legs. Mm-hmm. So there was always going to be trouble.
Yeah. Yeah. But don't you think, like, the thing I was saying about like the managers, though, I feel like that is also equally important. That in my mind, when they announced Lopetegui, I had this feeling that like, oh, this is the guy he's wanted this whole time, and he's just doing anything he can. He's moving heaven and earth to make sure he gets his man.
That's what I thought at the time.
And then you read reports that they were after Pochettino before that. They were after Klopp,
Allegri.
Yogi Löw. Yeah, potentially Yogi Löw. Then you factor in Zidane. I'm sure they wanted to keep Zidane. So suddenly you're looking at maybe their sixth choice is Lopetegui. That changes the narrative considerably again.
So I would like to move us on to talking about what blame Lopetegui has. So I read a really convincing article by Graham Hunter. I thought this is a show where we're exchanging articles we read.
That's fine.
Which is part of, to me, the whole Real Madrid thing, the entertainment of Real Madrid is this giant soap opera in everybody's opinions about what has happened. It's a fascinating club in that way.
And to be honest, this is my personal belief, is like I would rather listen to a show where people have read a bunch of stuff and are discussing what they've read rather than you and me speculate wildly from Richmond, Virginia, what's happening in Madrid, Spain.
Yeah. That's fair.
Yeah.
So Graham Hunter has this theory that Lopetegui, because he was, fourth, fifth or sixth choice for the job, actually was in a position of strength because they had nowhere else to go, right? There was I don't think there was any other coach that they could have gone to. So he could have said to Perez, yeah, I'll take the job. I want to manage Real Madrid. Obviously, he's always wanted to. But how about you do me the courtesy of letting me complete the job that I've been working on for 2 years? Let me do that and manage Spain at the World Cup.
Yeah.
How about that?
Well, see, so it's really...
And then he'd come in from a position of strength and maybe he'd be able to argue with Perez a bit more going forward.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of it in a relationship sense.
And that's fascinating to me because I hadn't thought about it like that. But it's almost like he's in a fake position of strength, in my opinion, because... the other thing we've heard a lot about, or at least I've heard a lot about, is the idea that Perez wants a strong manager to come in and kind of lock down the locker room, get everybody towing the line.
Yeah, he's a Mourinho fan, right?
Yeah.
Or maybe an Antonio Conte fan, someone who would come and yell at the players.
Exactly. Yeah. And we'll talk about that in a second because that's been interesting as well.
But succession plan.
Yes. Yeah. But it feels like for him to say, I want a manager who's going to like stand his ground, he's going to like be the authority figure, he's going to make everybody kind of do what he wants, and then Lopetegui's like, hey, can you not announce this, please? And he's like, nah, I don't care what you have to say. It's like you're kind of already showing that you don't really want that type of manager. You want a manager who's going to do that with everybody else but you, if you're Perez.
And I look at it as maybe Lopetegui coming in and almost being starstruck by Real Madrid. Like he sold his soul, essentially, to take this job.
It sounds hyperbolic, but you're not far off, I think.
Yeah. He didn't even learn how to play guitar.
He certainly sold... He sold his reputation, that's for sure.
So also Lopetegui, even though there are problems with the squad from last year, right, he must take some responsibility. I don't know the finer points of what's gone wrong tactically, but you don't go that many games without scoring, without some of it being your fault, right?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah? And I think there's an element of chopping and changing, of you're just trying different things and throwing stuff at the wall to see what fits. Because, you could say they were in a 4-3-3. Then I think there's definitely a period in El Clasico when they were in a 4-3-1-2. Then they switched to a back five. And I know that, you have to adapt if you've got an injury or what have you. But it still is the case that it felt like you could ask him now, what is his best 11 in formation? And he maybe could give you the 11 names that you would expect from Madrid, but I don't think he would say it with confidence, and I don't think he would be able to articulate a game plan that makes consistent sense.
I also wonder, in hindsight, whether he possessed enough authority to impose the style of soccer he wants to see on that Real Madrid team.
Yeah.
When you look at the Spain team, which actually had a lot of Madrid players in it, that Lopetegui managed from 2016 to 2018, so all the bit in between where there was no tournament, they had a kind of pressing style, right? I didn't see much pressing from Real Madrid in this first half of... Admittedly, I didn't see every game, but I didn't see it like a Lopetegui ball, right? Yeah. Julian Ball or anything like that, that was implemented at Real Madrid. It was more like he just went in there and just tried to ask his star players to to get the job done.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, and that is where you look at the firing announcement, and it was essentially like paraphrasing. It was very brief, so I'm already paraphrasing a brief statement, but it was like when you look at the history of Madrid and the standards that we aim for and the fact that there are like eight nominees for this year's Ballon d'Or, we're not where we should be or what have you. And that's where I say that's maybe true, but I think it's also then certainly some of the responsibilities on those eight Ballon d'Or winners and the rest of the squad.
I see that as being Perez having a hand in that. Obviously, Perez has a big hand in the wording of that statement.
Oh, 100%.
Of essentially making clear that, in his opinion, I'm doing my job. Look at all these famous players.
Yeah.
It's the manager who's failing to get them to play. I think it was Perez very carefully making sure the laser of blame was directed straight at Lopetegui.
I'm amazed that you use the word carefully, because to me, there's nothing careful about that. To me, this is
bluntly?
I'm aware of how hyperbolic, second time in this show, hyperbolic this is about to sound, but it reminds me of any dictator, and the one I'm going to go with here is V for Vendetta, when it seems like maybe V is having the influence and the chancellor is like, I want everybody to remember why things are terrible. Mm-hmm. This feels like the Nando Vila article had a point that one of the most recent fan polls was that 87% of fans blame Perez for the situation at Madrid.
Yeah.
And that statement is a reaction to that of, it's the dictator doubling down and be like, it's not me, it's this guy, it's these guys, it's his fault. And it's very definitively pointing a finger, as opposed to just saying, it didn't work out, we're going to part ways, we're going to try something else.
Yeah.
To go that hardcore at one individual, to me, feels like I'm panicking because the blame's on me and it's got to be on somebody else.
Again, it's the glorious soap opera that is Real Madrid.
I feel like I'm having deja vu. I feel like we maybe have had this exact conversation about Real Madrid a season or two ago.
Maybe when Rafa Benitez was let go?
Maybe, or maybe it was when Carlo Ancelotti was let go. Either one of those are possibilities.
Okay, what about, I think it was door number two, I guess was the biggest room because it had all the Real Madrid players.
Well, I would say the biggest room for me was Perez. I think he has the most responsibility. But yes, the players, certainly. And I think
the room with the most headphones in it.
There we go. And I think that's been the other really interesting part of this, is that as soon as it became clear or official that Lopetegui was not going to be with Madrid anymore, everybody reported, oh, it's Antonio Conte for sure. It's his job. As soon as Chelsea approved the signing, because I guess there was still
some paperwork,
that it was going to be Conte, then suddenly that went away. And it was initially, some of the reports I saw were that, oh, he had a lot of demands and he wanted specific control. Maybe that's true.
But wait, why does this make it the players' fault?
Because from what I understand, the biggest thing was comments like Sergio Ramos in the post-match interview. He came out, I think he was asked specifically about Antonio Conte, and he responded, respect is earned, it is not imposed. We have won everything with coaches that you already know. In the end, the management of the players is more important than the technical knowledge of a coach. Basically implying that he doesn't, not even implying, just straight up saying, he doesn't want a Mourinho. He doesn't want a heavy hand. That's exactly what Antonio Conte is. And I think that was basically him publicly saying, I'm not playing for a coach who's going to make me do things I don't want to do.
But then is he accidentally then revealing that the players had too much power and it's partly their fault that all these results didn't go their way?
Yep. Yeah. Pretty much. I mean, again, it depends on perspective, because I think he would say, no, we were at our best when Zidane and Carlo Ancelotti were kind of giving us not necessarily free reign, but a more relaxed approach. There's a term for it that's like using your left hand instead of your right hand in Spain, and that it's much more like, you guys can do what you want, but as long as, you know, you respect the game plan and show up on time, I guess it's all going to be okay. Mm-hmm. And I think he was saying that's when we flourish, when you respect the locker room. If you come in and try to tell us all what to do, it's going to be a problem.
Right, but this is about the problem that would arise if it was a Conte or a Mourinho or a disciplinarian appointment. What about what's happened in the past couple months?
But I think that's also representative of the fact that it is the sort of players, in my opinion, valuing themselves pretty highly and looking at it and saying, well, we're more important than a manager. The idea that managing a locker room is more important than bringing technical and tactical expertise is a surprising statement from Sergio Ramos. And so I feel like that to me says that the players...
The Sergio Ramos who chested the ball straight to, I can't remember the Barcelona player, for the fourth goal.
That was Antonio Conte's fault too. or somebody else.
You know the goal I'm talking about?
Definitely
though,
somebody else's. Oh yeah, the fifth goal?
Yeah.
Yes. Oh. Yeah, where he... And that's great play from Sergio Roberto to kind of put the foot across to make that tackle. But it's not a play you would expect Sergio Ramos to make. And it definitely made me look at him and think, maybe you've lost a step. Maybe you don't quite have the authority that you thought you did. But it is sequences like that where it's maybe you want a coach who's a little bit relaxed, But that Madrid squad looked pretty relaxed to me, and not in a good way, in a, eh, it's okay. Eh, we're doing what we want to do. Sure, I'll chest it down with two Barcelona players running at me full speed.
Ramos did chase back afterwards.
Yeah, but I mean simply that, like, you would expect a more dramatic play, or, oh, I've got these two guys closing on me from either side. Maybe I won't try to casually set it when I am the last defender.
Okay, the other element here is the reason I would have to blame the players is that I went back and looked at Zidane's quotes from his press conference when he was leaving. And obviously, when the news broke, all the focus was on the fact that Zidane was leaving, right? I went back and read a load of stories. A lot of them just have a quick quote, and then they're all about, like, listing his achievements of three Champions Leagues and how weird it is that he's leaving and all that. But Zidane had some very interesting things to say. He essentially said, if I don't see that I think we're going to carry on winning, if I don't see things as I want them to be, a moment arrives where you say it's better to change. And, like, coupled with what we talked about earlier, where they finished so far behind Barcelona, so far behind Atletico Madrid, Zidane, in hindsight, is sort of saying everything was not right, right? The players were not necessarily giving it their all for that final season, because that team should have been good enough to challenge Barcelona for the league, right? Good enough to win the Champions League, should have been good enough to challenge for La Liga. And it looked to me like they turned up for the big European nights, but not throughout the season.
Yeah. I mean, you're not wrong.
We've seen more of that this year.
But it was also the case, because we forget this, that a year ago the conversation was about how Madrid had let go of key squad players.
James et al.
Well, see, that's the thing, is that at that point, James was considered a squad player versus some of the players that we, like you have now. And I don't mean any disrespect to the current Madrid roster. It's just that when Pepe and James Rodriguez...
But DR7.
Yeah, are your squad players. That means that, like, you've got that depth. And last year, that was that conversation of, you've let go all these players with key experience that we could have used. That maybe factors into why Zidane leaves, and now they're doing it again with an even weakened squad.
So this is maybe a bigger picture problem. So rather than laying individual blame on individual people, a bigger picture problem of maybe Real Madrid not building a deep enough squad, right?
Yeah.
So because of, like, focusing on this goalkeeper, this expensive goalkeeper they didn't need, or an Eden Hazard signing, or a future Neymar signing, they focused on that. But maybe they should have been just replacing those fringe players with guys that really could come in and do a job and help out. Yeah,
yeah, I would say so. And instead, not only did they not do that, but they kept... Like, I understand why you would want to keep Gareth Bale, but that's Gareth Bale who has been... like, mocked and blamed for so many problems that even if you then hand the keys over to Lopetegui and say, like, all right, you've got a rejuvenated Gareth Bale, that doesn't mean Gareth Bale is rejuvenated. It means he spent the last 4 years or however many sort of being the scapegoat and the one who had to make way for Benzema, Ronaldo, and Isco. So suddenly to be like, okay, now it's him, that doesn't mean that he's going to rise to the occasion. It means he might take a little bit of time, and I think that's what we've seen. And so it still feels to me like, yeah, they haven't invested really anywhere in the way they needed to, and so you have the situation you have.
Okay, enough lame blame.
Yeah.
Let's look to the future. The coach right now is Santiago Solari, promoted from the B team.
Yep.
I read somewhere that some weird Spanish Football Federation
Nando Vila had that in the article,
too. Is that where I read it? That you can only be the interim... Dave Sarakin coach for 2 weeks.
Yes. US soccer doesn't have that regulation.
Santiago Solari Sarakin is the current Real Madrid coach.
Yes.
So we don't know what's going to happen beyond those 2 weeks, right? I assume it means that they can, if they don't find anyone else, they just offer him the job permanently.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the point that Nando was making in his article is that Perez did this previously. It was just that he had Zinedine Zidane waiting to take over. Santiago Solari is not Zinedine Zidane. And so you don't have that little bit of leeway, and Zidane sort of shielded him from a lot of the pressure in the fans because the fans were just happy to have Zizou there.
Yeah.
You don't have that level of enthusiasm for Santi.
Okay, yeah. So I guess maybe they'll just give him a couple of weeks, maybe to the international break, and see.
We'll see.
See what he does.
But it does sound like Conte is out of the picture. So I don't really know what else
he'd
do.
Yeah, it seemed like negotiations just didn't go well, and so they didn't go through with it.
No.
One note I want to add on Solari. Thanks to Zach Goldman, that damn Yank, on Twitter, we now know that Solari is the first Real Madrid manager who played college soccer in the United States.
Hey!
Did you know this?
I did not know that.
So Solari played 1 year at Stockton back in the day. I think his family moved to the US briefly.
Thank you for clarifying back in the day, because otherwise I would have thought it was yesterday.
Well, he probably could cut it in the NCAA. He played 1 year in the early 90s at Stockton.
Yeah.
There we go. So we have American college soccer player in charge of Real Madrid.
You're welcome, Spain. College soccer saves the day.
But so I'll be interested to see what Real Madrid do next, obviously, right? The next game is going to be a really important, interesting watch.
Interesting is the key word there, especially with four fit defenders. We'll see how well that goes.
Anything else to add before we move on?
Nope. I think we've covered all of what I wanted to talk about with Real Madrid, but I'm sure there'll be more to talk about
as we
get more names linked with that job.
Tune in next week for the next thrilling installment of Real Madrid.
Jose Mourinho would do a great job. That's all I'm saying.
you're trying to palm him off.
What? No. Yes.
Today's show, for the final time in October, is sponsored by The Athletic.
Yeah, it is.
So we've already mentioned the Nando Villa.
The assassination of Julen Lopetegui by the coward Florentino Perez. Yes, we have mentioned that one.
By the way, that is a great.
Oh yeah, it is.
Great headline.
Yep,
I really like that. So yeah, that is definitely worth reading. There's also a lot of US focused stuff
there.
There's a Paul Tenorio article. I don't know if he was breaking news here. Mm. I can't remember if it was breaking news or just reporting about how MLS might be getting rid of the geographical restrictions on development academies and the homegrown player stuff.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting.
I mean, you said that like you were skeptical.
No, it's just more so I'm curious to see how quickly they reinstitute those if they take them away.
Why?
Because I feel like certain clubs maybe get a little bit complacent with like, nobody else can come in our territory, whatever, we'll find these players when we find them.
Yeah.
And I think other clubs have much more of a stated emphasis on finding those gems and developing them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think as soon as you start having some clubs get players snaked from their territory and appear for other teams, you're going to see those franchises start to complain.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Without naming names.
I actually don't know who you're referring to, but it's going to be interesting. The big upside to me is it means more scouting of US talent. It means that if you're in a small metro area, you now can look at a large metro area like, say, Los Angeles, where there's probably too many players for the academies of the LA Galaxy and the LAFC
I know what you meant.
To catch all of them.
Yeah.
So some leftover players that just didn't have a path in because of the geographic restrictions, now they can go play for Portland.
Yeah. Right? And I think if you're
have
MLS...
To move, but, you know.
Yeah, a little bit. I think if you're MLS, it also makes sense from a perspective of you have, like, say, Josh Sargent, for example, who maybe didn't feel the connection to Sporting KC, but he would have had to play for them because that's how it works.
Yeah.
Suddenly,
he's from St. Louis, right? He's development academy was in St. Louis.
Exactly. Yeah. So maybe now, if there's a little bit more player freedom to choose who they want to play if they're recruited by a couple different franchises, then maybe that keeps them playing in Major League Soccer as opposed to looking for options abroad.
Yeah. Anything else you've read on The Athletic recently that you want to
Yeah, highlight? I think while we're talking scouting, Christian Dyer had a good one titled USMNT search for dual nationals continues with two US-born European-based players. Those would be Theosin Jordan Sibachu, which
I believe
he goes by Jordi, and then Kik Piri, who we've talked about previously on this
Dutch,
show,
right?
I believe. Yep. Well, American, but playing in the Netherlands.
Dutch-American.
Yeah, exactly. And I found this interesting, specifically the Piri one, because both of these players have been linked with the US in the past. Brian Chiaretta did an interview with Jordi about playing for the US, and the feeling, I believe, at the time was, well, we'll see if France or the Netherlands respectively want us, and then we'll see where it goes. And this felt like a little bit of an element of U.S. soccer wanting to remind everybody, hey, we're doing stuff. Like Ernie Stewart played in the Netherlands, like a director in the Netherlands. He's got connections. He's talking to people. Huh? Is this working for you?
You got time for a quick rant?
Sure.
So I would much rather the U.S. focused on going on the charm offensive to dual nationals who live in the United States, guys like Efra Alvarez, for example, Mexican-American, rather than making overtures to guys who are living in Europe and have been through the youth systems of European teams like Perry and Sibachu.
Is that what a rant sounds like from you?
I mean, yeah. It's a very
That was the smiliest, friendliest rant I've ever heard. And I feel
But you get what I'm saying? Like, you're going after someone who is maybe, I mean, I know you can't put numbers on it, but if you're like born and raised in the Netherlands, in the Netherlands youth system, but you've got some American connection, you're like maybe 25% American and feel like 75% Dutch. Whereas if you're literally, Efra Alvarez has talked about feeling 50-50 because he just is, right?
Yeah.
He's Mexican-American and it's like a push and pull between these two things. So why waste your time going after players who really should be Dutch?
The face I'm making is not because I don't understand your point. It's because, come on, Daryl, it's U.S. soccer. Like, what better thing to do than to go like rambling about abroad trying to find people and just ignore everybody in your own backyard and assume they'll just stay there, because why not, as opposed to all of the other national teams that are starting to look around and think maybe that player could play for us instead. I saw a story, maybe we talked about this, about Peru starting to look a bit more intently at American shores for Peruvian American players. Yeah.
Uh-oh.
I think it's not just the Mexican national team that are starting to look at dual nationals. So maybe maybe U.S. soccer should pay a bit more attention there.
All right. Hopefully they will. Maybe my my impassioned rant will change their mind.
No, maybe it will, but it has...
It was a towering piece of oratory.
It was beautiful. But it has brought about a little bit of panic for me, which is appropriate, because the other one to talk about would be the MLS Cup Panic Rankings by Adam Snavely.
Yes.
Always great. He's brought them to the domestic side for this one. And I did love this because it, without spoiling much, it legitimately made me want to see Peter Vermes and Bob Bradley fight. that's alluded to. And I will just say the pairing of Atlanta United and the Tata Martino news with the song, like the turnaround song, so good. So good.
Is it played on like a weird flute?
Well, there's that too, yes. That makes it all the better.
All right, so that was just a sampling of what's on The Athletic.
A 45-minute sampling.
45-minute sampling of what's on The Athletic.
Yep.
If you want to get a subscription, you can get an annual subscription to The Athletic for 40% off. That's 40% off the cost of an annual subscription. If you go to theathletic.com/TSSOctober, that's theathletic.com/TSSOctober.
Thank you to The Athletic for sponsoring today's episode of The Total Soccer Show. It's good to have them back. It's good to have Daryl back because I want to talk about some more domestic things in the form of the US U-20s.
Ooh, okay. Oh, before we do, can I just mention to people that the MLS knockout round is coming?
No.
I just had it in my head to make sure to mention Wednesday night, Halloween night, when no one's busy, no one's doing anything. There's two playoff games, NYCFC versus Philadelphia Union and FC Dallas versus Portland Timbers. We'll be reviewing both those games on Thursday afternoon's show.
Are you going to a Halloween party?
Yes.
Are you going to put as much thought into your costume as you did last year? And do you think it will be better received?
It's going to be. More and hopefully yes.
Okay.
No, actually less and hopefully,
and hopefully
yes.
More. There we go. Daryl went as the Hex
the
last
final
time.
Hex standing,
and so. I have to say, that was amazing. My favorite part remains all of the weird little Halloween stickers you put around it. Because
yeah, I overstick it, right?
Well, it's just more so that it was such a beautiful insight into Daryl Grove of, it's too bland. I need a bunch of tiny stickers. That's what's going to really make this sucker pop.
Stickers of ghosts.
There you go.
And then Thursday night, it's DC United versus Columbus Crew and LAFC versus Real Salt Lake. This is my favorite round of MLS playoffs.
Why is that?
Single elimination.
There we go.
None of this two-leg nonsense. One game, you're either going to make it through or you're not. I feel like this is where all the drama is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
100%. Yeah, because you've got the scrappy teams scrapping with that one game.
Yep.
If I could give you a Halloween suggestion, I would say go as a ghost, but label yourself the LA Galaxy playoff hopes.
Ooh.
Hi, friends. Hi, friends out there. How are we doing? Everybody good? All right.
Do not co-sign. Do not co-sign. expect reviews of those games on future Total Soccer shows. Okay, you said it. U20 CONCACAF Championship is starting this Thursday, right? It's happening already.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Thursday, November 1st is the first game. I think, so this is qualifying for the U20 World Cup, which is in Poland in 2019. Before we get into the roster, because Tab Ramos has named his 20-player roster, can we get into the format of how this thing works?
Please.
Because it is wacky.
It is.
It is, right? So, in the next... So, starting November 1st, in the span of 9 days, the United States under-20 team is going to play 5 games.
Should be easy.
Should be a lot of soccer, right?
Yeah.
So, there are 34 teams in U20 World Cup qualifying. They are arranged into 6 different groups. The US is in a group with 6 other teams, so 5 games... in 9 days. You have to win the group. So if you win the group, you then go to a second group stage, a group of 3 teams.
It's the old school Champions League style.
Right, yeah. When they're trying to squeeze as much money as possible.
Yeah.
You get to a second group stage of 3 teams. All you got to do is finish in the top 2 of that 3-team group to qualify for the World Cup.
Yeah. Then you have to win the joust and you have to win the coin flip best 4 out of 7, I think it is, right?
Yeah.
Is that how it works? Okay. Yeah.
Then you have to complete the, was it American Ninja obstacle course?
Well, yeah, of course.
In under 2 minutes.
I mean, that goes without saying, Daryl. Come on. And then just to reiterate, you said it before, but one more time, if you're new to soccer and you have this idea of like, oh, there's a qualifying tournament, it works the same way that qualifying for, say, the Women's World Cup works,
it's
where you have
similar.
Your like regional competition and if you win that or finish in the top 2 or 4 or what have you, then you go.
All right. So, as we said, for the group stage, 5 games in 9 days and only a 20-player roster. The good news is it's not too strong of an opposition, right? It's in chronological order, Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands, Trinidad and Tobago, which is the tough game, I think.
I've heard of them.
St. Vincent and the Grenadines and Suriname.
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm confident we can win that group, but it's not guaranteed, mostly, in my opinion, because of the presence of Trinidad and Tobago.
Yes. Right? I mean, yes. And it's worth noting, like, it's never fair to compare the U20 national team to the senior national team, mm-hmm. just because you've got a lot of unproven players or, like, not exactly veteran players coming through. And so it's easy to look at, say, when you get to the U20 World Cup and think, like, oh, we're in a group with this team, this team, and this team. We're going to get destroyed. But, like, Serbia, I believe, won the last one or won the second most recent one?
2015.
There we go. Yeah. So, like, looking at that one, like, it's worth remembering that just because one senior team might be good or might not be good, it doesn't mean that their U20 team isn't.
But I would bet good money that Puerto Rico, U.S. Virgin Islands, Saint Vincent and the Grenadines, and Suriname are U20 teams that the U.S. could handle.
I mean, we'll see.
We'll see.
We'll see. But yes, I am being deliberately difficult. Yes, I would say so too. Yes.
And then let's get to the roster, because this is a tough time to – it's a tough calendar time.
Yep.
To pick a strong roster, because teams don't have to release their players for any of it. But the first group stage part takes place outside of an international window. So you have to persuade teams to let players leave the team during the season and come and play in this tournament, which is this time is happening down in Bradenton, Florida, at the IMG Academy. So I think when most people take a glance at the U20 roster that Tab Ramos has selected, 20 players, they're going to say, where are all the guys that I know?
Yep, pretty much.
Is that fair?
Yes, yeah. 100%. Yeah, because, I mean, the big ones, Timothy Weah, Josh Sargent, not here, not
Chris
included
Durkin,
on this roster.
Andrew Carlton, not there, not on this roster.
I've heard of all those fellows.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
They can be called in after the first group stage for the second group stage, but they are not, if they're on the 35-man preliminary roster, which has not been made public, but they're not on the first roster, right? For me, this makes this tournament kind of interesting for us, because we're going to get a look at some of these lesser-known names.
Yes.
Yeah?
I mean, and we will get to – if we don't get to see every single one of these players, then it's telling. Because as you said, the frequency of the games and the likelihood of injury means I think we're going to see a lot of people get a lot of minutes.
It's going to be every other day. It's play a game, day rest. Play a game, day of rest, and repeat until you've played 5 games.
Yeah.
Everybody has to play some minutes.
Yeah, and Travis Clark and Adam Bells did a great roster breakdown and a good look at this tournament from a U.S. perspective on this week's episode of the Top Drawer Soccer Show, which is already out.
Edited by Mr. Tyler Rockwell.
It was indeed. And one of the things I would point to as being a slight concern for me would be Mark McKenzie. And I know that you and Adam also talked about him, I do believe.
Yeah, okay. So Mark McKenzie, if you're a Philly fan, you'd be very aware of him. He is a 19-year-old who's been playing a lot of minutes in Major League Soccer at centre-back for Philadelphia Union. He's one of the few actual centre-backs on this roster. Actually, to my mind, there's only two actual centre-backs.
You are correct.
McKenzie and Sam Rogers of Seattle Sounders 2. All the other guys who can play centre-back, like, say, Jalen Lindsay and Julian Araujo, are actually full-backs who can play centre-back. But then McKenzie has a playoff game on Halloween night.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
He has a playoff game October 31st, and then the first US game is November 1st. He can't play in both. We probably could find it if we did some hardcore research. I would love to know where he is right now. Is he in Florida or is he in the Northeast?
I mean, I would assume he's in the Northeast.
Right?
That would be my guess.
MLS playoffs.
Yeah, I think so, because that would be the priority. And I think, as you said, if you're not compelled to release your players if you're an MLS franchise, then why would you get rid of a player you might need for a playoff game you have to win?
So is this Tab Ramos? Has he gone crazy? What's happening?
I think what you all said on the show, you and Adam, I believe it was you and Adam, said like maybe he's just hoping that maybe they don't go that far.
Yeah, but with so few centre-backs, right? So, or then does Tab Ramos just back this team to, like, you know, have some full-backs play centre-back and it'll be fine anyway?
That's the answer. Yeah.
Is there a level of arrogance there that we should be concerned about?
It's US soccer we're talking about.
Or do we trust that Tab Ramos, I don't know the answers to these questions, but do we trust that Tab Ramos understands U20 qualifying so well that that he's made the right call here?
Yeah, sure, that sounds good. Let's go with that. I mean, I honestly don't know. I would guess that, as you said, the majority of the teams in this group you would look at and think maybe we should have more of the ball and we should be focusing on attacking and how we're going to play against a bunkered team, and maybe you're not so concerned about your center backs. And
so if there's a fullback who's good with the ball, then it's great. They can play center back and it just gives us more more attacking options or yes. more people who are comfortable. Well,
that certainly.
Passes.
But I'm also saying that like if you're playing a team that you – if you and I are playing a team that we expect – like our team expects to beat 5-0 mm-hmm. and we know then that they're going to be ultra defensive, we're probably not so concerned about what center backs are – what are they going to do and how are they going to defend as much as we are. How are we going to find openings and opportunities and get goals against a team that's going to be ultra defensive?
Yeah, okay.
So I think maybe that's what he's looking at is I want McKenzie when I can get him. Maybe thinking he won't go that deep or Philly won't go that deep. If he does, he does. We can call in some replacements if we make the next round. But right now I'm focused on how do we build this team out from the back and then how do we get goals? How do we make sure that we beat the teams that we should beat?
Okay, I think you've settled my nerves.
Okay.
I'm still a little bit nervous
about it because, again, I'm not really – I said it in jest that it's U.S. soccer we're talking about. But, I mean, we have been hoisted by our own petard before and we have
with CONCACAF arrogance.
Yep,
like
exactly.
October 2017. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes, so I would hope that that does not happen again.
Yep.
We shall see. But we shall also see, as you said, a lot of players who maybe we've read a lot about, seen in bits and pieces,
yep.
but we'll get more of an opportunity to see on a regular basis in the next couple weeks.
All right, so here's my question for you.
Sure.
I think if listeners want to hear like a detailed breakdown mm-hmm. of basically every player on this roster – go and find this week's Top Draw Soccer Show. Find it in, you know, Apple Podcasts or iTunes, as we still call mm-hmm. it. Any podcast player that you have, go subscribe, go listen to it. It's a really good episode of the Top Draw Soccer Show. Also, my episode last week with Don Hughes, I thought was pretty good. All about futsal. Go find that as
yeah,
well.
Dan was good.
I was a good teammate.
Hi, Danny.
So I had my foot on top of the microphone the whole time, so I was doing it right. For you, are there any?
See, you've never played with Danny, have you? You've been on the same team as him, have you?
I've been against him.
See, that, I was going to say,
him around.
You would know that if you were on his team, the correct thing is to just give him the ball,
yeah.
and then say, "Bye, Danny. Go do stuff. You're very good."
I tried to take the ball from him, and uh-huh. I said, "Oh, bye, Danny. Good
yep,
stuff."
There we go.
Please stop doing stuff. Anyway, a detailed breakdown is on the other show.
Yeah.
But what names jump out at you, Taylor?
I mean, Ulysses Yanez is
Ulysses
the one.
Okay,
yes.
Why so?
Currently unattached, according to U.S. Soccer.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's...
It's weird that they included stuff about his personal life.
Right? You wouldn't expect that. Yeah, right? He's playing the field. I think because, as I said, a lot of these players are people that we get scouting reports on
mm-hmm.
or we watch in bits and pieces here and there in clips on Twitter or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So... to be able to like watch a full game, not saying that we're going to watch every single game in its entirety, but just to see is the hype justified
yeah.
on a different level with a different team? Is he able to keep it going? And I do think that he's going to be one of the main attacking threats for this U.S.
yeah.
team. So to see if he can handle that weight at this level,
yep.
I'm fascinated by.
And for those who aren't familiar, Ulysses Arnez mm-hmm. is part of that LA Galaxy Academy yep. Class that was coached by Clyburn.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like this big hope for American soccer
yeah.
In many ways. Efra Alvarez is kind of a contemporary, even though he's, mm-hmm. I think, a little bit younger. I imagine we'll see Ulysses Arnez on the wing in mm-hmm. a sort of 4-1-4-1, but it won't be that defensive, so it'll basically be a 4-3-3,
yep.
and you'll see him attacking mm-hmm. from the wing. So keep your eyes on Ulysses Arnez.
Yeah, yeah, I would say the same, in my opinion, goes for Ayo Akinyola. That's another one who we've seen going back to that 2015 tournament, or I feel like he was at the
he was at the U17
Thank
World
you.
Cup.
My bad.
Yeah.
Which was like the same time period, right? It was mm-hmm. one of those like, oh, that's a tournament, and then there's another tournament,
yep.
and then there's another tournament.
Yep. That's going to happen in 2019 as well.
But he's in
hopefully.
Hooray! But he's another one who I feel like we've tracked for a very long time, and we've seen him bits and pieces. I don't think we got to see him when he came to Richmond with TFC2. I think it didn't quite work out, as mm-hmm. I recall. But he's one who has gotten minutes with the senior team, has gotten a lot with TFC2. But I still – maybe in like, contrast to Ulysses Yanez, I'm more excited to see him because I want to see if – he has raised his game to the next level or
yeah.
if he sort of is continuing to play right around where he was last time
I
we saw him.
I always found him to be very direct
mm-hmm.
and like not full of like, not enough tricks almost.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So yeah, I'll be interested to see.
That's fascinating for you to say. That is not a usual Daryl Grove statement.
Well, okay. Well, I guess it's true, right? So there's also Alex Mendes mm-hmm. in central midfield. That's a guy I've heard a lot about. I know Adam Bell's on Scuffed and on Top Draw Soccer Show
yeah.
Has talked a lot about the type of player that Alex Mendes is.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, he's a midfield badass.
Yes.
So he can be the holding midfielder. He could be one of the two more advanced midfielders. And he's going to sort of, I imagine we'll see Alex Mendes He's another one of these LA Galaxy kids. I imagine him seeing him boss the game. I want to see him absolutely boss games, knock people over, set the tempo, make things happen.
The idea of any American bossing any game is exciting to me, aside from Julie Ertz. We're used to that one by now, yes. Speaking of Alex Mendez, though, we did get a few reports on some of these individuals. Russell Varner sent us a scouting report on Alex Mendez, 18-year-old American midfielder for SC Freiburg. Obviously, he was named to the U20 squad, as we've already said. Mendez took to social media to announce that he had signed with SC Freiburg. That announcement came on the heels of being included in this squad. And as we said, with the lack of Carlton, Sebastian Soto, Josh Sargent, Timothy Weah, it seems like we're going to be seeing Alex Mendez doing a lot of the creating for this team.
All right. Do you want to go through the rest of the U20 reports then?
Yeah, let's do it.
We got one from Paul Braff about Anthony Fontana, who is also on this roster. Paul says, after being hurt for most of August and September, Anthony Fontana has started the last six games for Bethlehem Steel FC. So he's got some games under his belt. The team is undefeated since his return, and he's gotten some solid minutes, and he's on that U20 roster.
Hooray, Anthony Fontana. And I believe Paul went with a don't you want a Fanta line, something like that, which I quickly removed from the scouting report. Michael Thompson scouting Chris Gloucester, 18-year-old American left back for Hanover 2. As expected, you could probably guess, he was included on this roster, which should be good for Chris Gloucester, as he has, I believe I just said he was included on this Gloucester. Hooray for me. Mm-hmm. This should be good for him, as he only has one substitute appearance for Hanover 2 since his last national team call-up in September.
Interesting. Yeah, he's a guy I'll be really looking at for, Chris Gloucester. We expect him to play left-back, be the starting left-back for this U20 team in at least one of the games.
Can I tell you an important fact about Chris Gloucester?
What's that?
I've made this mistake several times. Not Chris Goslin. I do that a lot with the names. It's too close for me. It's too close.
Can I tell you a soccer fact about Chris Gloucester?
You may.
Since that move up to Hanover 2, apparently he spent a little bit of time with the U19s, before Hanover 2, playing on the wing as well. Ooh. So we may see him in more advanced positions as well.
Okay.
Versatile player. Sean Figgins is scouting Mark McKenzie, the aforementioned 18-year-old American defender for the Philly Union. I said 19. I still think I might be right. Sean says Mark worked his way back into the Union starting 11 for the final three games of the season, played well and showed improvement on the ball from his early starts, where he was too slow too often. So he's on the U20 roster as well. Thank you to everybody for those scouting reports.
Oh, you forgot the extra part of that scouting report where Sean added, he is definitely 18 no matter what Daryl says. I have no idea what's true.
So here's another big takeaway I have for this roster is, in many ways, I'm glad that it doesn't have Weah and Sargent and those guys on there, because we've seen a lot of them, right? And because we're up against this weaker opposition, again, we start with Puerto Rico, then U.S. Virgin Islands, it actually is a chance to look at, just to rattle off some names, Alex Mendez, get a good look at what he can do. Paxton Pomykal, a guy we've been talking about for a long, long time. He's had a few little goes with FC Dallas, but never really got himself a proper first-team spot. These are players that we haven't really seen a good chunk of minutes.
Yeah.
We'll get to see it. We'll finally get to see it.
Yeah, I agree. And I would also add that with the some of those players you named, specifically Sargent and Weah, it really would be a no-win scenario for them. Because if they come in here, they get kicked a lot, they get fouled a lot, but it's also two players that we've seen play for the national team. Then you have that expectation of, playing against U20s, they're going to destroy everybody. Mm-hmm. So if they have an off game or they don't score as many goals, it doesn't look as good. And if they do score those goals, then you think, they were going to do that always. So there's really no way they could have come in and really made us go to that next level of enthusiasm. Maybe if they get called into the knockout round and
when
win
really
the CONCACAF championship, then maybe that changes.
All right.
But Josh Sargent scoring six against Puerto Rico, that's not going to make me think he's any better or worse.
Yep. But if he scores two against, say, Costa Rica in the final group stage,
I'd be okay with that.
I would give more than this.
I would give more than a golf clap.
So if you want to watch these games, and I really think people should not watch all of them, maybe, but dip in and see good chunks of it.
You said you're going to watch all the St. Vincent games, right? I found that surprising.
Yeah, check in with me on that.
All right.
They're being screened by CONCACAFGO.com.
Yeah, so I just really like the idea of you filing fake reports about St. Vincent, because I would not know whether or not they were real.
It would all be about the band.
Yes.
So CONCACAFGO.com is weird. It's like CONCACAF's own streaming service that I think they plan to charge for in the future. But if you go there now, all you got to do is sign up with your email.
The bait and switch.
It's free. No, you don't have to give your credit card or anything. It's free until December 1st. So if you go to CONCACAFGO.com, you really can sign up to watch all these games for free. And I'm sure it will work flawlessly.
Of course. It always does. They always will.
Can I just say one final thing is, I think the game to watch is the Trinidad game, right? So if you only decide to watch one of these U20 qualifiers, watch the Trinidad game because it's going to be, I assume, the biggest challenge. And that's going to be the team that we presumably the team we have to beat or tie and then better in the other results to finish top of the group, which is what we have to do, finish top of the 6-team group.
There we go. I think you and I will probably be paying attention to all of these games, but yeah, we'll probably give a little bit more attention to that Trinidad game.
There we go. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's and also Tobago, both of those things.
One final thing before we get to the other scouting reports. Did you see the FIFA news a few days ago?
Yes.
That I feel like didn't hit big, but I think is important for the future of the US men's national team.
All right. Why don't you stop teasing and start talking?
So FIFA Council approved Copa America 2020. Mm-hmm. So there's still going to be a regular 12-team Copa America 2019 in Brazil. Then, starting in 2020, there's a new Copa America, and then it's every 4 years from then on out. That means that the Copa America will no longer clash with the Gold Cup, which means we could get an invite and we could send our best team.
Hooray!
Yeah.
It does mean that you and I are going to have a very busy every 4 years.
Yeah.
Two tournaments. Yeah.
Hopefully it'll be like 2016 when we had the Euros and then we also had that combined CONCACAF and CONMEBOL Copa America Centenario. Because I also think even if it's only a 12-team Copa America and we're invited, that's great. But this does open it up to having a Centenario style 16-team CONMEBOL CONCACAF tournament every 4 years. It would give us our version of the Euros all the time.
100%.
So we would now be in 2-year cycles of major tournaments instead of 4-year cycles of major tournaments, with all due respect to the Gold Cup.
Yes, and it makes me very excited. I remember leaving this office when we were still in the CONCACAF and then, or excuse me, in the Centenario and then Euros stage, where we left, I think, as the sun was coming up and realized that we had to be back here to start watching games in like 5 hours.
Yeah.
Even with that said, I'm still very excited about this, especially because it really does. This is not why they're intentionally doing it, I'm sure, but it does work out that it really does remove that obstacle to the U.S. competing. And so it sort of forces their hand a little bit that if the U.S. is invited, they don't really have a good justification for why they wouldn't go.
Because if people don't know, the thing used to be that if you had the Gold Cup at the same time as the Copa America, apparently it was a FIFA rule. This is what Sonogalati said to my face, right, at the coaches' convention.
Yep.
It's a FIFA rule that you have to send your strongest squad. I mean, yeah, I made that more dramatic than it needed to be.
And at least he answered your question.
He did, right?
No such luck for George.
You have to send your strongest squad to your local tournament, right?
Yep.
So the U.S. always would have had to send its best team to the Gold Cup and then a B team to the Copa America, which we've done before and it hasn't gone well, right?
Not so much.
We did it in 2007 as well. Did not go so well.
Let's not speak of it.
So that obstacle is absolutely removed.
Yeah.
This is possibly huge for the U.S. men's national team.
Yes.
Spread the word.
So we're still going to have Gold Cups. We're still going to have theoretically, possibly, maybe Copa America and then theoretically, possibly, maybe the World Cup too.
Yeah.
Busy summers.
Yes.
Busy summers.
Busy summers coming.
Throw in a Confederations Cup too while you're at it. Why not?
I doubt we ever see one again.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wait, you mean because you don't think the tournament will exist or because we'll never get past Mexico?
Yes.
Okay. the optimism. Thanks, Daryl.
They got Tata now.
Thanks, Daryl.
They
don't, though. Did you see that report today?
Yes, share with me. What?
That was the other aspect of the turnaround song that I couldn't tell if Adam did intentionally, is that there were reports today that he was maybe having second thoughts about the Mexico job. That might be wishful thinking Atlanta fans, creating rumors. I don't know, but that was just a headline I saw as I was packing up to come into the office today. So we'll have to track that and see what happens.
Yeah, I love tracking a good rumor.
All right.
All right.
I also love tracking scouts, or specifically reading the reports of people who are tracking players. Yeah, there we go. We got there eventually.
Yeah.
We've got more scouting reports to get to.
It was mostly me.
Nah, it's fine. Starting with Nick Imhoff, scouting Emmanuel Sabi, 20-year-old American forward for Hobro IK. Sabi has returned from the injury that held him out of action for the last three league games. He started and played 83 minutes on the left of the front two in a 4-4-2.
It's a very specific scouting report.
Yeah. The Twitter account at FutureUSMNT noted that Sabi was, quote, the best player on the field, helping Hobro to a huge 1-0 win, end quote.
The famously unbiased at FutureUSMNT.
You don't know. You don't know what they're about.
I'm saying they're obviously going to be hoping.
You have no idea what they regularly tweet about, Daryl. That's all I'm saying. The Hobro website said, via very rough Google translation, that the Hobro attack was often led by Sabi using his speed to send crosses into the box. I'm assuming that meant using his speed to get open to send crosses into the box and put the back line under consistent pressure.
All right. I do actually like the at future USMNT handle, just in case anyone was Misled.
Too late, shots fired.
Jeff and Sam Huffman are scouting Mukwele Akele, the 21-year-old American attacker for Villarreal B. Jeff and Sam say, the past month has been a positive one for Mukwele, representing Villarreal in the U23 Premier League International Cup. He earned and converted a penalty in the team's 1-1 draw with Swansea, and a rebound off his dangerous shot fell to a teammate for the game winner in a 1-0 victory over Hertha. For Villarreal B, he had a brace in the 4-1 win over Sabadell and has generally been a regular starter or sub for the thriving team who sit in second place in their division.
Yeah, we go. I have to say, this might be the most positive scouting reports we've gotten in one consistent reporting segment. I think really? We've only got two slightly negative.
Huh, maybe tell your face.
All right, maybe I will. Serious face. Ian Schenk, scouting Fernando Arce Jr., 21-year-old American midfielder on loan at Dorados de Sinaloa from Club Tijuana. Fernando Arce's rise under Diego Maradona continued this weekend.
I love that Arce being under Maradona gives us a chance to talk about Maradona in the scouting network.
Also, and speaking of which, happy birthday, Diego Maradona, I think. I do not like you. He played the full 90 in the midfield and notched the game-winning goal just before halftime against TMFC. Arce drifted off his marker on a Dorados corner and headed into the far corner to score his first goal of the Apertura.
Steve Renard is scouting Yuri Tielemans, the 21-year-old Belgian midfielder for AS Monaco. After spending the international break with Belgium...
I love this report.
Tielemans returned to his club side, now under new management, Thierry Henry,
yep.
To score the consolation goal from the spot in a 2-1 loss to Strasbourg. Unless one is looking for a clinic on poor defence, worse goalkeeping, and how to get dumb red cards from Monaco, I would not bother watching the highlights. Though the tandem slide tackle from Strasbourg defenders that leads to the penalty kick is well worth a look. Trust me, I'm on it. I'm going to go watch that.
It is legit, like, Glitch in the Matrix style. It is strangely...
It's like an identical...
It's like two players coming in from the same direction, and the final replay of it, if you can find it on YouTube, the highlights, they both just come sliding into frame in just the exact same way. It is truly majestic and magisterial, to steal a word from Ray Hudson.
Enough to make Trinity worried.
Yes, exactly. There we go. Good stuff, Daryl. Manny Alcantara scouting Junior Firpo, 22-year-old Spanish left-back for Real Betis.
We had a change in nationality.
We have indeed. He is now... no longer Dominican Republic eligible. Firpo made his Europa League debut last Thursday, playing the full 90 against AC Milan. Junior played well and contributed an MLS assist in Real Betis' first goal of the game, which they ended up winning 2-1.
Ryan Marzak is scouting Pione Sisto, the 23-year-old Danish attacker for Celta Vigo. Pione Sisto continues not to have the chance to assist for Celta Vigo. Five of his last six appearances have been substitute appearances of 45 minutes or less. Ryan speculates that Sisto's grueling schedule last season and then the World Cup this summer could be playing a role in his form this season. I want to call him now Pione Sitso.
Oh, that's terrific. I'm happy that the time, I mean that sincerely, by the way. I'm happy the time in the sauna didn't like shrink your brain or anything. That's good.
I didn't turn it on.
You didn't?
No.
What's the point then? Sweaty podcast in. Guy Yedwab scouting Serge Gnabry, 23-year-old German winger for Bayern Munich. This is a long one, but a good one.
Okay, I'll sit comfortably.
All right, Gnabry got his second and third starts against AEK Athens and Mainz. And with more time, Guy is able to see why Gnabry hasn't had the impact with Bayern that he had with Hoffenheim and Bremen. At Bayern, like at Arsenal, Gnabry is being asked to stay wider in the attack and target the box for crosses, and his crosses don't look as focused as they need to be. At Hoffenheim and Werder, he was typically running at the goal directly himself. That said, he was more involved in the Ike game, and afterwards when he was asked about starting while Thomas Muller sat on the bench, he responded, "When I don't start, a top-class player is also sitting on the bench." Well said, Serge Gnabry.
Like next to him? Andrew Eggleton.
Shots fired from Daryl Grove.
I like his confidence. Andrew Eggleton is scouting Ollie McBurnie, the 22-year-old Scottish striker for Swansea. Andrew says, Ollie McBurnie is up to 6 goals and 2 assists in 15 games after scoring 2 in Swansea's 2-0 win against Reading. The first was from a penalty and the second was the culmination of great build-up play by Swansea, who are really something to watch this season. Ollie needs to be a bit more clinical in front of goal, but his work rate off the ball creates a ton of chances for the team. He also was a late sub and then started in Scotland's 2 games during the international break.
Go on, you unicorns.
Unicorns? Oh, Scotland. Yeah.
Yeah. I wish that's what they were called.
Maybe we can get that started.
That was more of a pigeon, wasn't it? I don't know. Is that a good unicorn? I don't know what they make.
I've never heard one. All right.
It wasn't quite as beautiful as I think it needs to be. I'll work on it.
Needs more magic.
Certainly not a pigeon.
Thank you to everybody for the scouting reports. They sound like baby Chewbacca. So thank you to everybody for the scouting reports. If you'd like to support the show, please go to totalsoccershow.com/join. or subscribe to The Athletic, theathletic.com/TSSOctober. See, I just kept going. I'm a pro.
You're used to my nonsense.
Taylor Rockwell, thank you for taking the time to talk to me today.
Right back at you, buddy.
Listeners, thank you for listening. On Wednesday, should have a new show for you. The plan is to talk to Adam Whittaker-Snavely of Panic Rankings fame, not necessarily about Panic Rankings, but about Borussia Dortmund. We're going to check in on what's happening at Borussia Dortmund. Jadon Sancho versus Christian Pulisic.
Oh boy.
Yeah. It's going better for Sancho right now. I'll say that.
I mean, I don't know. We don't know. Yeah, you're right. I have no way to say this other than that you're absolutely right.
Scored two goals on the weekend.
Pulisic could do that if he wanted to. It's not all about scoring goals, Daryl. Sometimes it's about making 28-minute appearances here and there.
Listeners, thank you for listening, and we will talk to you again tomorrow.